listening to The Liminalist, the podcast between at horticulture.com. This is Jason Horsley, and this week I'm talking to the author, researcher, and stand-up comedian, Matthew Alford.
You went back to America earlier than you expected then?
Canada.
Sorry. You know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, I haven't been in the US in 20 years or something. Well, except the time I snuck over the border and got snatched by Homeland Security. I was there for like half an hour. Yeah. No, I don't. I'm persona non grata in the US.
Oh, how come?
It goes back to my early 20s when I foolishly responded to an interrogation at immigration honestly, and when they asked, like, have you ever smoked marijuana, I'm like, yeah, sure, who hasn't? And then, have you ever purchased marijuana? Well, yeah, okay, anyway. And they were obviously taking notes, and then they let me know at the end of the interview that I had given them enough information to ban me from entering the US for the rest
ever.
Of my life. Well, it was a perma ban, and I kind of made it worse because I kept trying to get back in, and so my file got bigger and bigger, because at a certain point they didn't even know why I wasn't allowed in, because, you know, the original offense was buried under all these other occasions where I'd been, you know, fingerprinted and handcuffed and all the rest, and then kicked out. Anyway, and but then on this last occasion, because of how much hassle I caused them, because I slipped over the border. You know, I did it the Mexican style, and waded through a river and all the rest of it from Canada to the US, and I would have been entirely successful, but I hadn't. This is the thing that you learn in TV shows about prison breaks. You've really got to plan what you're going to do once you're out. Don't just figure out how to get out of prison, but make sure you know where you're going to go when you're out. Otherwise, you just get picked up right away. And that was what happened. I hadn't planned ahead. I didn't have anywhere to stay. Once I got into the US, it was nighttime. And so I ended up just wandering around, actually trying to walk somewhere. And anyway, long story short, I got picked up. And they were so kind of puzzled by the whole thing when they found out I was a writer, and they were reading my Amazon reviews and all this stuff, and they were so puzzled because I didn't fit the profile of somebody who would be sneaking in, and I obviously wasn't worth all the time and trouble that they had to go through processing me like I was a terrorist. So they fixed it so that my ban would be lifted in 5 years. Apparently.
So actually, by breaking into America from Canada,
yeah,
you actually reduced your sentence.
I did. I improved the situation, although I haven't tested it yet, because it's been 5 years now, but that's what they said.
How many countries was Henry Kissinger banned from in the end? Belgium, wasn't it? And then there was a couple of others in the Middle East. I can't remember what they were.
What did he get banned for?
Well, war crimes. He was wanted for war crimes in a few places. I always thought it was kind of interesting, you know, one of the most sort of powerful deep state actor, the most long-standing, couldn't go to certain countries. And it was also quite funny because he advertised, he didn't advertise airlines, but he advertised The Economist, and he was in an advert in the late 90s where he was on a plane. I always thought it was quite funny that there was only a certain number of countries that he could actually go to in that plane, because he was going to get arrested for war crimes if he turned up in the wrong place. But
he could, I don't know. Presumably take a private jet. If you're Henry Kissinger, there are probably ways around customs now.
Oh, yeah. When you have a private jet, though, surely you have to go through something.
Yeah, you're supposed to tell someone, otherwise you get shot down, no?
Yeah.
I don't know what the rules are for that. Like, for these movie stars, Tom Cruise and whatnot, because it's an in thing in Hollywood. It's definitely a status symbol, isn't it? If you haven't got your Learjet, you're not an A-lister. So I wonder what the protocol is there.
Well, there must be. That's because they need to get airspace on it. But it's also it's a bit less of a status thing now because it's you get criticised for using private jets, don't they?
Oh, that's right. The
I don't know
flight.
if you were here. Were you in here in England when Prince Harry and his wife Meghan got criticised for using a private jet to go to an environmental conference?
Oh, it's hilarious. No, I didn't hear that, but I've heard about flight shaming, the Extinction Rebellion, so I was kind of half expecting to get eggs thrown at me, next time I went to the airport, but so far I've not been flight shamed.
I bought a pair of jeans today. And my Extinction Rebellion friend was like, should you be doing that? You should sew up your old ones. I
Right.
was like, I'd have to learn to sew. She was like, I've got a sewing machine. I was like, yeah, but maybe that sewing machine was made in a factory by little kids. I felt like I was in the wrong, but I wanted a pair of
You
jeans.
can't be in the right in the
No.
context of Extinction Rebellion, I don't think, unless you kill yourself, then you win the prize.
And even then, you're not allowed to be cremated.
Right. Yeah, you'd have to maybe go into the forest naked and get eaten by a bear. That might be the most ecologically.
Actually, I think that is a criticism, isn't it, of Extinction Rebellion from the right. But actually, I think it's a horrible stereotype, really. I don't think I've met anyone in Extinction Rebellion who doesn't acknowledge that they are part of this capitalist system, that they're part of consumerists, that they are over-consuming. It's just that they're aware of it and they think that they should do something about it. And on a bigger scale, on a systematic scale, and on an industrial scale, governments should intervene to deal with the other big chunk of it, the other big problems associated with it.
Sure.
Everyone who I've met in Extinction Rebellion, no one is saying, no one is. I know it's funny to have a laugh about it, like with my jeans, getting yourself eaten by a bear and all that. But I've not ever met, and I've been on a few of them. I've not met anyone like that. I mean, they're a bit, they're aware of it. And they're scared of where the world could go. I tried to write a piece about that actually with Exile, with or not directly Exile, but I was looking into. I'd contacted a climate change doctoral student. She was about to complete her thesis, and she was looking at the relationship between the Pentagon and carbon emissions. And eventually, actually, someone else beat us to it and wrote a journalistic piece that put across our argument really very well. And it was that basically, the military industrial complex is a really important part of carbon emissions. I mean, I can't remember the exact statistics now because we hadn't arranged to discuss this, but just as a sort of as an aside from memory, through domestic use, the Pentagon has got a carbon footprint of something like the size of Norway, which is, something like, it's in the whatever top 100. It would be in the top 100 countries in terms of emissions if the Pentagon was a country. And then what we were trying to then piece together, and it hasn't quite been done. Even this hasn't quite been done, but I think it'd be really good if someone did it. Is well, if we're talking about the Pentagon being, the size of a medium-sized country in terms of carbon emissions, what about the role of the arms trade? If you then factor that in as well, and what about the role of when the Pentagon is actually doing stuff outside of its own borders? Because this is just talking specifically about the Pentagon itself, not everything to do with American foreign policy. So what about the use of industrial jets? What about the other? What about military training? What about what about wars themselves? And that seemed to increase it by another factor of such of several. And it was our kind of estimate. We were trying to think to sort of finger our way, is that right? feel our way towards an estimate of how much the military industrial complex contributed to carbon emissions. And we're not quite sure because we never got to the end of the research, but we think it might be something like between 1 and 10% of global carbon emissions comes from the military industrial complex, if you then include Britain and and China and all these other things. So actually a huge amount could be done to reduce pollution, reduce carbon emissions, simply by, you know, by the old-fashioned things of anti-war, anti-war movement and demilitarizing the planet.
Right.
I don't know the exact statistics on it, but I bet you it's about 10%.
Did you see that documentary Cowspiracy?
No. Do you know what? I'd love to see that. In fact, I'm going to make a note of that right now because I've heard people say that several times. No, is the short answer.
But you know why I brought it up. I mean, you know the general gist of it. Yeah, the meat industry is responsible, supposedly, for a vast percentage of the, I think it's specifically carbon emissions. I'm not really up on the jargon.
And probably methane as well, is it? If it's to do with cows and all that.
Yeah.
Or specifically breeding cows. Yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly what that's about, but it's like there are these, I've always kind of seen it that there are these sort of cancerous aspects of society which aren't really doing any good. Like the arms trade is not doing anyone actually any good, just in the same way that the tobacco industry isn't actually doing anyone any good.
Mm-hmm.
But they're kind of these malign appendages to society, and it's not like anyone's going to lose out if they are destroyed. I mean, there might be a few, you know, there will be a few individuals and a very small number of jobs, which would be nothing compared to the way that most industries are let to rot by governments.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like there are rational solutions to make the planet a lot healthier and make human society a lot better, and there's no real reason why those things can't be done. You know, it's just not done. So
isn't it a bit like I mean, you used the metaphor of a cancer, but isn't it similar to that in that one can isolate the tumor possibly and possibly surgically remove it, although with the military industrial complex or the meat industry, obviously that's easier said than done, but theoretically one could, but one can never be sure that the cancer, it hasn't spread to the whole body. So even removing it isn't guaranteed of actually resolving the situation.
No, I mean, it's not quite as straightforward as I'm putting it, I suppose, because there is obviously a demand for meat, and arms is a similar thing kind of going on there. But I suppose I'm just saying that on rational principles, a lot could be done, even if, you know, the problem with cancer is that if it does stay in a living body, you know, it's going to eventually, it will eventually spread, and most types of cancer will kill you. But the in this case, you know, if one person in the world ended up owning a gun, then it's not going to be the end of the world, you know. So I don't know if it's quite the same as don't know if the biological metaphor necessarily needs to stand up. You know, what we're trying to do is stop planet from being unable to sustain human, animal, and plant life, and
which is a biological.
There are pretty good ways of doing that, I think.
It is a biological problem, isn't it? We're talking about the ecosystem, the whole biosphere, and all the rest of it. So, I tend to find that certainly when we talk about socio-political problems, I always go to the psychological, and when I go to the psychological, I actually end up. Certain sense with the biological too, although I'm clueless about biology. It was my worst subject in school. But in terms of the whole body, I think of, you know, problems in society do relate to psychological principles, and then those also relate to problems in the body. So I kind of see it as a whole, definitely as a whole spectrum. And we try to be rational, but of course, as has been said so many different ways, human beings aren't necessarily primarily rational, are they? I mean, they certainly don't.
No. I'm not saying that they are. I'm not saying it would be easy to solve that. I'm just saying, if, you know, on the premise that we are, or on the premise that
we could
more
be.
On the premise of, you know, governments have got a responsibility to be rational, I suppose. I think that's a fair point to make.
Yeah.
I expect, and I hope, and I demand that my government is rational. because I think they should be looking after their people and indeed international society. And therefore, if, you know, and if they don't live up to that, then I've got the right to criticize them and try to replace them through, particularly through democratic means. And it seems to me that, you know, in all sorts of different ways, our governments are such a long way from being rational that they're more pathological than anything else. And that's, and so to demand that they are, that they act rationally, I'm saying that one of the benefits from them acting rationally is that actually the changes that we would see in our society and in the health of our very ecosystems would be really quite substantial, simply by governments acting, you know, rationally, not even acting nicely, really, not going out of their way, but just not acting pathologically would be a pretty good start.
Yeah, well, I certainly won't argue that, but it is, I mean, it's a problem when you're approaching a pathological individual, because they're pathological, they don't know it. That's part of the pathology. And some pathologies entail the belief that, of the opposite, really, that they or the person or the group in question actually knows more or sees reality more clearly. That can often be symptomatic of a pathological delusion. And I think that that's what we're probably looking at in terms of the ruling classes or the cryptocracy, is how I look at it, because I think it's largely in secret, the rule via propaganda and all these other methods that you've researched. I think that they, it's hard to talk about them as individuals, but I guess we've mentioned Kissinger, and he's an example of somebody who seemed like a shadowy ruling elite, kind of behind the scenes kind of guy. I don't know much about him personally, and I haven't met many of these people, but I suppose I've got probably more experience than most, because I grew up in a family that at least, you know, rubbed shoulders with these kind of, with the ruling elite.
Why was that? Why was your family involved with, you know, why were they rubbing shoulders?
Because of, I mean, it's a bit of a chicken or an egg, which came first, because I'm not sure, like, how it came to be that my grandfather and then my father were running a multinational food conglomeration. But that would be the answer. I mean, food is such a central part, the food industry, as we've just mentioned with the meat thing, is such a central part of geopolitical control that, it makes sense that a massive food corporation would be hooked into government and other agencies. But I don't quite know how it came about. I mean, that's one of the things that I tried to get to the bottom of with Vice of Kings, was, you know, what point did my grandfather, how did he go from this supposedly working class child in a family to Oxford and then Nigeria, district officer in Nigeria, to running this multinational corporation. And I actually don't know the answer, how that happened, whether he was already hooked in, like his family, whether I come from an aristocratic family that hit hard times and then was restored, or whether we were somewhat self-made. Yeah, I still don't know. I mean, one of the things I discovered while researching was my grandfather was born in Ripley, and next, very close to Ripley, a few miles from Ripley, is a town called Horsley. So what is that, a coincidence? And I don't go into, you know, David Icke and bloodlines. I don't know anything about that. I don't know how anyone could really genuinely research that. Maybe it is possible, but I certainly don't think David Icke has. But I don't rule it out either. I mean, Jimmy Savile also, like the Savile name is certainly an aristocratic bloodline, and he referred to his mother as the Duchess. I mean, maybe it was just a joke, but as we know, Jimmy Savile, a lot of his jokes had these hidden meanings. So it's possible that he's an example of somebody who was actually part of a hidden bloodline, who was therefore, he, even though he was born working class, he was known by, you know, his by the ruling classes, and so his career was facilitated. As, I mean, that's wholly speculative, but it is possible that things like this happen.
Yeah, or just that he was such a kind of, you know, like when we met, you were talking about how evil people just keep doing these increasingly evil and disgusting things because it gives them a kind of power or confidence or whatever it is.
Right.
I wonder how, I wonder when he started doing his abusive activities, and I wonder if that did feed into, I mean, it certainly didn't make him a very likable or comical sort of a comic figure. He was pretty revolting character even before anyone knew about the abuse, but maybe it did give him a certain, I don't know, sort of arrogance perhaps that, that allowed him to be, you know, he always said that he invented DJing, didn't he, for example.
Yeah.
And if you've got, if you've got that kind of arrogance through the what's the word, the sort of self-entitlement of habitual abuse, and maybe that gives you that kind of confidence to say, oh yeah, I invented DJing.
Or it's true. I mean, those
it
early,
might be true as well. Yeah, I don't know.
Those early years of Savile are very little documented, but they're quite fascinating because, as early, I mean, in his early 20s, I think, he was both hooked in with the you know, gangsters running clubs and stuff, and this early DJing, obviously the two, you know, the two combine, those two worlds overlap right there. With it, when you're running clubs in Leeds, then you're also, you've got venues for prostitution and gambling, and therefore for, you know, gangster interest, and obviously the, you know, it's an opportunity for pioneering, you know, DJing, as he claims to have done. And as I uncovered in Vice of Kings, this overlap with mass observation and these social engineering plans of using music and dance, particularly dance music, for propaganda purposes. I don't know if you read those chapters, but that,
I don't know if I read that, but I've kind of, as with most books, I've kind of gone into it at various different parts and not actually read it cover to cover. So sure. Yeah, remind me of this bit.
Well, yeah, it's definitely of relevance to your own research, because it's, I mean, I don't have the names and the dates and all that at my fingertips, unfortunately, but it's in the lead into World War II, so in the 30s, there was a concerted effort to use dance tunes and dance clubs, where people would, obviously that music could be played, to generate support for the war, basically. So these songs were deliberately written that would instill people with patriotic fervor and want to support the war and sign up, and then those songs, and then dance clubs were part of the, you know, means of delivery, the means of introducing people to those songs and getting them emotionally involved in them. And when you're not just listening to a song, but you're dancing, singing along, obviously you're really getting into it. And so all of that, I think, was not all of it, but the basic, that basic methodology was worked out in advance and as a propaganda method. And so then it's impossible to separate the emergence of dance culture and nightclubs from government propaganda. And Jimmy Savile was, and also, as I said, mafia, organized crime, and Jimmy Savile was right at the center of that.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
Jimmy's Kingdom, is that the chapter?
Yeah, I guess
LSE,
so.
NHS, and the beginnings of psychiatric social work and childcare.
Actually, that's later on. So that's
mass observation and dance halls.
Yeah,
Jimmy Savile's beginning. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I think I get to the point, as we, I think we discussed when we met, that I don't think I could have ever written a book like the one that I'm holding at the moment, yours, because it's so much looking in the abyss. Thinking about Jimmy Savile too much. I mean, I've written a little bit about Jimmy Savile, but I can only do it for so long.
Yeah. Well, and then, of course, I went into Aleister Crowley, which is an even deeper, darker abyss. So, I sympathize. I mean, obviously, I sympathize with myself here, but with your perspective also. I mean, I wouldn't have chosen to is the answer to that. It was my wife who kept talking about Jimmy Savile when it started coming out about him in 2012, and she'd never heard of him, right? So I grew up with him, as you know, and she just kept saying I needed to look at him, and I just didn't want to. But when I started to, that led to part one of Vice of Kings, and discovering these intersections with my family. So it became not compulsive, but necessary. It really felt necessary to go into that. And then the same thing kind of happened with Alistair Crowley. Like, I really didn't want to go there, but I was actually very interested in Alistair Crowley as a role model. So I again, I kind of had to go there.
I think I was very convinced by the bits that I read on Crowley in your book, and the idea that he had presumably assaulted a child as part of his kind of desire to try to sort of become more powerful through evil and disgusting acts, which I don't really quite buy. But I did think that your analysis of that was really rather convincing and disturbing. So yeah, why did you see him as a role model? Do you mean that you sort of like the kind of sort of vibe he was? I don't know. What do you mean by that?
Well, it answers, I mean, it addresses the question you put on Facebook, isn't it? Like, what was in it for Crowley, and how exactly did any of this work out for him? And I certainly agree that at a deep level, a psychological level, a spiritual level, or a human level, none of it did. I mean, he ended up as this heroin addict in Brighton, and I think probably a very miserable human being. I think he probably was the whole time. But in terms of,
That's interesting. Is that how he died?
he did.
It's funny, isn't it? Sorry, it just reminds me of Ayn Rand. And I can't remember the specifics of the end of her life, but as someone who preached independence and free markets, and you're aware of this, and she just ended up dying in a particularly lonely, friendless, hated, hateful, angry existence. And it's all, I wonder if there are parallels there between those two sort of ideological figures, but also other people who kind of try to promote this, these quite fringe views that are kind of pushing the idea of, I don't know, I don't know if probably Ayn Rand would not call herself evil, but do you know what I mean? Like, sort of pushing this idea of, reliance on self, and sort of the will to power and all these kind of things. I'm not sure if that does tend to work out very well for many people psychologically or, and in practical terms, they just end up seeming to be, complete wrecks. Unless, of course, you're a psychopath, and if you're a pure psychopath, then maybe it can end up right. But actually, sorry, my cat just jumped over the computer. But maybe even then, I don't know if psychopaths sort of
No.
have the end of, the closing years of their lives sort of being particularly sort of joyful or serene. It's an interesting question, though.
Kirk Douglas comes to mind there, as far as he's now 102. So
Yeah.
by all surface accounts, he's had a gloriously successful life, and he hasn't even, been outed as a, sociopathic predator, which I believe he was. But anyway,
Oh, that's interesting. So he was that bad, was he?
he allegedly viciously raped Natalie Wood and traumatized her for her entire life.
That was, oh, I didn't, I, okay. Yeah, I knew about Natalie Wood. I just didn't know. Okay, I didn't have his name properly linked with that, but okay.
Yeah, his family have come out and said that was who it was, that he was the culprit.
Yeah, sorry. That's an interesting one, isn't it? That, I guess for some, I wonder what the correlation is then between that kind of long and happy lives, or long and serene lives,
Long and
and
successful,
evil. or long and successful. And I wonder if there's, I wonder if that is, maybe there is no correlation. Maybe some people who are really nice.
There's money, isn't there?
Oh, there's money, I suppose.
Money and
yeah,
power.
Yeah. I'll have to look that up, actually, the thing with Natalie Wood.
I can send you something that's in my...
Yeah, I'd love to have a look at that, actually. Yeah, I did look into that a little bit a while back, but
yeah,
I'd like to do that properly. Okay, sorry, continue.
Well, let's go back to Ayn Rand, and then we could get to the more general thing of, you know, how it works out for these sociopaths. Ayn Rand, I think, was... She did advocate evil because one of her heroes was this serial killer whose name I don't have at my fingertips, but who tortured and murdered a little girl or more than one, and she posited him as her ideal man. So this is a little known fact about Ayn Rand. You know, as with Crowley, it's not hidden or anything. With Crowley, there's a legion of these facts that get de-emphasized, and somehow what gets emphasized in its place. And Crowley was, you know, more than Ayn Rand, although Ayn Rand did have this kind of, she did, in a certain sense, didn't conceal the pathological egotism of her philosophy, but tried to kind of make it, give it a positive spin. So in a certain sense, like with Jimmy Savile, there was a kind of glorifying or parading what couldn't be concealed.
Yeah, so although you're saying that Crowley was much more overt and not afraid to you know, kind of shout about and publicize his sort of glorification of overtly and obviously objectively evil activity and characteristics, you're saying Ayn Rand did actually also buy into that but just didn't publicize it quite so much?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know what to what extent, but glorifying a serial killer, that's pretty, I mean, even it's hard to imagine even Crowley doing that.
Right.
But it's in there. It's obviously a, you know, an important detail. But with Crowley, yeah, his avocation of evil, if you like, or transgression, was embedded in, or like a scarlet thread running through, you know, quite a large philosophical and magical and, you know, pseudo spiritual oeuvre.
I see a bad moon rising. I see trouble on the way. I see earthquakes and lightning. I see bad times today. Don't go around tonight, it's bound to take your life. There's a bad moon on the rise. Don't go around tonight, it's bound to take your life. There's a bad moon on the rise. Hear hurricanes blowing. I know the end is coming soon. Fear rivers up and rising. I hear the voice of rage. Don't go around tonight, it's bound to take your life. There's a bad moon on the rise. Don't go around tonight, it's bound to take your life. There's a bad moon on the rise. put your things together. Hope you are quite prepared to die. Looks like we're in for nasty weather. One eye taken for another eye. Don't go around tonight, it's bound to take your life. There's a bad moon on the rise. Don't go around tonight, it's bound to take your life. There's a bad moon on the rise. Don't go around tonight, it's bound to take your life. There's a bad moon on the rise.
I'm round in magician Crowley. You think that what they were able to get from it was money and power in a way, or notoriety. Was there Crowley? How do you say it? Crowley. Yeah. Was Crowley a wealthy guy?
No. I mean, my point about Kirk Douglas wasn't that he got money and power out of it, but that, which obviously he did, but that in terms of him having a life that looked on the surface to have been a good life, if you've got lots of money and power, then it probably would look that way. I mean, you've got healthcare, you've got life extension, you've got hair transplants, you've got lots of women, you've got all kinds of things that are superficially appealing to us. Obviously a movie star and the acclaim as well. Like, if you manage to maintain your reputation as primarily just a cultural icon and not, if all the other stuff about your antisocial behavior or whatever is suppressed, then basically it all looks good, doesn't it? We don't actually know.
I still wonder if there is, how clear this correlation is in any way between sort of behavior. Even if a movie star or whatever has assaulted someone, you know, that could be, in the case that you're talking about, that's decades into their career anyway. And there's plenty of movie stars, famous people who are sort of decent people or normal people, or people like Keanu Reeves are known as astonishingly lovely people, and they seem to do just as well financially and with women and all those kind of things. I'm not sure if there is a correlation between sort of evil and success, or evil and unhappiness, or anything like that. I think maybe it's all just a bit incidental, really.
Well, there's two questions. I mean, evil and unhappiness, I think we'd have to make a correlation. Otherwise, everything really is just kind of disjointed. As in, if one was not unhappy, why would one be abusive and tormenting to people, unless we're going to have some sort of metaphysical evil, which I don't really go for. And then on the flip side of that, if one lives a life where one is abusive and cruel and basically doing things that are abusive to oneself, really going against one's own life force, then one couldn't really be happy, I don't think. Anyway, that's my viewpoint. As far as the other thing, evil and success, I mean, that is a big question. What I've been trying to map throughout my last few books and this current one is about Hollywood, is that the system itself appears to be set up in such a way that, as in any institution, really, one has to pass through a number of initiations, if you will, or grades or trials or tests in order to establish oneself within it, and that the nature of those tests or those initiations seem to me, as with organized crime, we're talking about Jimmy Savile and this kind of entitlement that he got through acts of abuse or this feeling of power, that would be kind of inseparable from how organized crime functions in terms of who gets to, who gets to attain a certain degree of power within organized crime. They have to commit acts, right? They have to kill, okay, they have to steal, they have to, otherwise they wouldn't be considered of the right stock or of the right material. So I think it's pretty clear that something like that happened with Jimmy Savile. It's definitely what was going on with Crowley that I map in terms of the magical systems of initiation and so on, the left-hand path of transgression. So, and we also know that to some extent it's true in the realm of politics, I think. So why would Hollywood be different? That's my question. I mean, that is a big question that I try to answer this current book. Would it be different? And if so, why? Because as you know in your own work, people in positions of power in Hollywood have an enormous amount of social, political influence. Like they are delivers, agents of propaganda, whether they know it or not.
Yeah. It's a really, really hard couple of questions, those. They're big philosophical questions. It would be interesting, wouldn't it, to, if there were more psychologists on the case with that.
Yeah.
Has there been any published sort of research, or is it too much of an amorphous sort of psychological set of questions to actually be able to conduct proper experiments with?
Well, that's a good question in and of itself, actually. This is one of the quotes that I found for this book, is how little attention has been paid to the power of narratives as propaganda in the field, even though it's known that narratives affect our beliefs and behavior much more than actual, you know, more polemical kind of media, as in advertising and so on, right? Or political discourse, that we succumb to narratives in a way that we don't succumb to logical argumentation. So actually the power of narratives to shape human behavior or act as propaganda is much greater than is recognized, and people aren't writing about it. So the same with this. Yeah, there's so little I've been able to find on this subject, and it's partly why I'm trying to fill that void, really. I'm trying to write the books that I can't find to read, because it just seems so central to our lives. You know, the culture that we're in and how it's affecting us, and who are these people, who are these establishments and organizations and these individuals who are instilling us with these values. That's bringing it back to Crowley or Ayn Rand. It's really important, I think, to look at these people's lives and what their values add up to, both in terms of the full picture of what the ideology is and what it's, the kind of behavior or the kind of attitudes that it's selling, but then also what kind of lives did these people live? And as you point out, with Ayn Rand,
been able to get a sense, Jason, of how many people in the kind of sort of uber elite are actually into sort of esoteric practices, black magic, demonology, and all hidden knowledge side of things? To what extent do you think that actually does happen? I mean, obviously there are a few individuals that you've mentioned here, but how widespread do you think that is? How conscious do you think it is? How consciously is it pursued?
Gosh, I'm tempted to say I don't know, but obviously that's such the short answer, and it's not really accurate, because again I've been trying to map this, but there isn't a short answer, for one thing, because one of the elements here is that I think there's an advantage in claiming to believe these things, or in using the values. I mean, it's a bit of a circular thing, because one of the principles of magic is you adopt certain beliefs in order to attain certain ends, but you're aware of doing so, as in you're not believing them in the way that we unconsciously believe things, that we just think that we know something is a fact, and we don't look at, you know, how we came upon that belief or how it was installed in us. That's you know, the normal kind of belief. But the kind of magical belief is you actually say, I'm going to believe this, and then used the belief as a means to manipulate reality, including my own psychology, right? Mm. Which is a bit of a complex thing in and of itself, but it's like you're altering your own consciousness and then seeing how that will obviously change your behavior, but also will it change the way that people react and respond to you? Will it change your reality?
I think I sometimes think that sort of magic and esoteric thinking, to me, sorry, my computer's going. Sometimes it seems to me that it's a bit of a, it's kind of stating the obvious, really. It's just what people do, like, to develop confidence or sort of neuro-linguistic programming or something like that. I was saying, someone said to me that I was quite a magical thinker the other day, and I said, well, what do you mean? And she sort of goes, well, you know, you make a lot of lists and things. And I'm like, are you telling me that writing a shopping list is sort of, you know, because it's putting something down on paper and then saying, by the end of today, I will own a new pair of jeans. It's like, and then I made it happen. It's not magic. It's just making a shopping list.
Well, actually, that's the broad definition of magic that Crowley coined, was it's the art and science of bringing about change in conformity with will, which is pretty much everything, really. I mean, you could combine
just making a plan. That's not. I don't really see what's. I don't really get what magic is, because it doesn't really.
Well, it's anything. Well, it's like, I mean, an area of overlap here between what you're talking about and what, you know, the official magic of Crowley and whatnot would be obsessive compulsive behavior, which my brother had. So, you know, people who are OCD, they often do weird rituals, and if they don't do them, they feel that life's, you know, going to go wrong. So my brother used to have to turn his light on and off 12 times every time before he left his apartment, or things of that kind, or even touch wood. You know, many people do touch wood. Well, that's obvious magical thinking, right? And the person doesn't have to believe that touching wood has any kind of scientific effect on anything, but they do believe that if they don't do it, they're going to get worried that they'll bring about the thing that they're afraid of. You know, however that works, it's a sort of semi-conscious thing of that they're placating themselves, or they're, you know, reassuring themselves, and they're trying to generate confidence by touching wood, or whatever else it is. So if you imagine that extending all the way into a satanic quote-unquote ritual, in which, you know, robes are worn, candles are lit, incense is burnt, a child is sacrificed, the blood and the organs are devoured. These are behaviors that are totally divorced from ordinary social behaviors that you can do in the world at large without being arrested. You're creating this bubble in which you're consciously and deliberately making yourself behave in completely anomalous ways, based on the belief that you will get the favor of Satan, whether or not you believe in Satan or not, but you believe that somehow you will generate the power that Satan represents to then transform your reality. And of course, if you participate in a ritual where you're, you know, murdering and eating children, you can imagine it's like soldiers who've been in the war and they come back, if they're not too traumatized, and they feel quite invulnerable, because ordinary reality is just like a movie compared to what they've been through. You know, they've ascended to this other level where their consciousness has actually had a full-on encounter with a much more brutal side of reality that then makes ordinary social reality, it's just everybody seems like kind of puppets to them compared to the power.
But even that doesn't seem to say anything a great deal in favor of magic, or the correlation between magic or evil and success or anything. People who come back from having killed people in warfare are often completely screwed. They've got post-traumatic stress disorder. Don't function well in society.
That's why I made the proviso about if you weren't overly traumatized. I agree, most soldiers, because they're not autonomous, they're just following orders, and then they enter into this shitstorm, you know, of carnage. and the rationale they've been given for it is just lies and propaganda, then they're not psychologically prepared. So yeah, it's not a great analogy. You would have to go back to the Braveheart kind of warriorship, where you could see that people really men really became men in a very brutal, you know, limited fashion.
Oh, I see. Yeah, so you're sort of saying that actually modern warfare is, because everyone's just such a cog in a machine,
yeah,
they don't have the agency that one would have to become a kind of more powerful figure through a much more conscious entitled set of acts.
Yeah,
set of brutal acts.
Yeah, so it doesn't act as initiation, and you end up with, you know, Travis Bickle rather than John Wayne. You know? So
it's interesting. I mean, the nature of evil that you're looking into is really interesting, but it's very hard to sort of come to firm conclusions on it, isn't it? Because they seem like such big amorphous, difficult questions.
I mean, it isn't possible. I don't think it's even desirable to come up with a short, condensed version a la David Icke or Alex Jones. You know, by definition, they're not really useful. They're people find them appealing for weird reasons, right? But they reduce a sociological reality to a, you know, a fairy tale story, really. And I think they serve the interests of this, what I call the cryptocracy. That's why I say it's difficult to separate how much ruling classes might actually believe in the occult and practice the occult as compared to how much they want us to believe that they do. And I think it's both, but I think that the way they practice the occult isn't really what we think of as the occult. It's more of this very primal, ancient, atavistic practice of brutalization by which they separate themselves from the collective society that they want to control and dominate.
Did you see that photograph of, must have been a year or so ago, of Jeff Bezos, the head of Amazon, eating an iguana?
No.
Didn't you? It's peculiar. It's fairly recent, and I think that it's, one wonders, you know, how did that come about? It would be interesting to if there are details on the, you know, that have been reported on that. I mean, mm-hmm. It's either that he's gone to a dinner and, you know, there's kind of you can imagine it almost being like, oh God, there's nothing, you know, we're all being served this like fried iguana, like a whole iguana, like a full animal. Hmm. And it's like, oh God, how embarrassing, am I going to have to eat this? Maybe he's at some kind of, I don't know, foreign country and has to do it as a sort of polite thing. But the other assumption, perhaps the one that you and I would be more inclined to, is to think, well, he's kind of done this. He's eating an animal that just most people wouldn't eat because it's weird, and it's like, it'd be like saying I want to eat steak, but actually, can you bring me the face of the cow? Because mm-hmm. then I can, like, it makes me feel more mental. And I don't know, I just wonder, like, in Bezos's case, he might be one of these people who are pretty lacking in a conscience, and I wonder if that's part of it, like that kind of occult way of thinking. Yeah, you know, the next thing I've got to do is you know, butcher this, an animal that no one else has thought of.
Yeah, and also making it a little bit public, or making that entirely public,
and then photographing it. Yeah, yeah,
as a way to. I mean, there's also the blood boys, you know, these Silicon Valley CEOs and whatnot who have their blood boys, you know, that they have these young boys come in and and give them their blood for a few hours every week. I mean, that's obvious vampirism done in such a way that it's socially acceptable, but possibly is the tip of a hidden iceberg where, you know, where they do it in less socially acceptable forms. Also, Richard Dawkins, you hear about him advocating cannibalism?
No.
Yeah, he was saying it would be great when we can synthesize human meat, because then we can break the taboo of cannibalism.
Huh.
And that whole idea of
what's the good of that?
Exactly. Well, it's the whole idea of breaking taboos. I think, you know, if you think about how taboos are central to controlling society, obviously, because, you know, you've got things that can't be done to keep it civilized, then the people who control and dominate the society themselves, part of how they do that is they break the taboos. So they're not beholden to the same laws that the people that they control are.
Yeah, it's interesting. Eating things will be one.
Fucking things, killing things, eating them, just all the primal stuff. Huh?
Like they
obey the law of the jungle, and then they create a society in which all the members are cut off from their natural instincts and have to obey the law of the lions, you know.
With the stand-up that I've been doing recently, I mean, I've always sort of, you know, dabbled in sort of saying sort of horrible things, but I've been, you know, just to see sort of what might land. And recently, I've been thinking, why am I doing this? It's not very good. It's just kind of being a bit sort of shocking, talking about all those kind of things. And I think actually that is part, now that I think about it in the context that you're discussing it, and I do a thing about that fantasy of machine gunning people and beheading people and things like this. And they're the bits of my comedy that are perhaps, they've not worked, generally speaking, not worked, and they probably aren't funny enough. But I think I've done them partly because if you can say anything, if you can say the grimmest, grossest thing on the stage, then it does give you, it makes everything else much easier to do. And I wonder if that's a kind of, maybe that's my equivalent of Jeff Bezos eating an iguana and then taking a photograph of it. That's the way I'm kind of going in terms of that's what my evil is doing sort of bit gross jokes about right. things. And actually maybe, and I've realized just literally the last few days, I mean, I have, everyone who's a comic, you know, ends up saying offensive things one time or another, and then you sort of decide whether that's a good thing for you and everyone else or not. But just recently, I've done it a bit, and I've been thinking, well, actually, no, I need to take a step back from that, because it's just, I think I need to have some more respect for myself, and why do I want to raise these things? Maybe there's something better I should be talking about. And so, and I know that there is, because I've done it lots of times, but I think it's, in a way, it's quite good to, in a safe way, you know, obviously if I ate an iguana, that would be different, but, you know, to say some offensive things sometimes can be quite, gives you that kind of confidence to know that you can do it, and then you, but then I think it's good to be able to step back as well.
Well, and in today's climate, of course, as you know, it's pretty easy to say offensive things that shouldn't be offensive, whereas if you talk about ripping people's heads off and eating them, that really should be offensive. I mean in a certain sense I do agree that one needs to be able to laugh at everything in a way, but certainly post Jimmy Savile and this, the whole thing around Pizzagate, there was definitely some fire under that smoke, and some of it was the jokes about, you know, pedophile jokes and whatnot. I think it's how that culture, that abuse culture, conceals and conveys its perversities and its aberrations is by making jokes about it. So I've definitely become more aware of that. Like, I don't want to participate in that. But on the other hand, there's plenty of things you could joke about that should be joked about and that will offend people, but that shouldn't offend people, and that it's well worth freeing oneself up there. Like, you don't want to feel restricted about, you know, making a joke about some guy with a penis claiming that it's a female penis or whatever. Wherever we're going to go, right? It's actually, that stuff's considered more offensive now than probably even than rape jokes at this point, but certainly than violence jokes, right? So I think in a certain sense your work's getting easier because you can still explore that, like how to individuate and not be restricted by these ridiculous taboos without actually playing into this other thing, which is the sensationalization of violence and of evil, which I think really is, that's actually pretty trendy and hip now. That's the funny thing, is that along these two things have been evolving together. I think that things that shouldn't be offensive have been becoming more and more offense giving, and things that should be offensive are becoming more and more permitted.
Yeah, that's another one of those big patterns and correlations that is hard to pin down, Jason. Do you know what I mean? Like the trends of offence and all that. You know, how to summarise all that? They're huge questions. I don't know if I've got clear answers to those.
There ends that conversation with Matthew Alford. If you want to find out more about Matthew, go to the link in the show notes. Next week, the podcast is with Carl Raschke, the author of Painted Black and other works. And after that, I don't know. I'm hoping I'll have a conversation with Gib, who's been on the road for a long time. Saw the Joker last night at the local cinema. And thought that would be worth a bit of deconstruction. Might ask Phil Snyder as well, the expert on the clown, hero, psychopath triad. If you want to support me and this podcast, if you like it, if you appreciate it, if you enjoy it and you want it to keep happening, then spread it, share it, let people know about it, and or donate at the website. Also, if you've read Vice of Kings, if you got it from Amazon, if you want to review that there, and you have 7 reviews currently, which is a bit paltry. I think that's it for one more week. This is the Liminalist, Jason Between Horsley, the podcast. I wouldn't have noticed it passing, except for the turning of night into day, and turning the day into cursing. You look at me now, don't think I don't know what all of your eyes are saying. Does he want us to believe these ravings and lies? They're just tricks that his brain's been a-playing. A lover of women he can't hardly stand. He trembles, he's bent, and he's broken. It's true, but I say unto you, hold your tongue until after I've spoken. I was taken by pride and pleasures I'd known. I'd laughed and I'd said I'd be forgiven. Turned round, eyes blazing, and said, my friend, we're holding a wedding. I buried my face, but it spoke once again. Night to the day we're abiding. And now the dark air is like fire on my skin. And even the moonlight is blinding. And now the dark air is like fire on my skin. And even the moonlight is blinding.